All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and that is Decisions from Outer National. And that's what it's all about these days, isn't it? Decisions. And the decisions you're making these days are far more important than usual, all right? And the show today actually really is going to concentrate some of that. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Andy Z, spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City and co-initiator of RefuseFascism.org. And we're going to be talking about what's going on, what's facing people, and actually what are the people being called on to do and why it's important and what the situation is today. So I really look forward to that. Before that, we'll be listening to another piece from a speech that Bob Avakian gave a while back, and it was a speech that was called "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the Name of Humanity, We Refuse to Accept the Fascist America. A Better World is Possible." And this is from the Q&A section. We'll be listening to one of these, and it's about the role of students. And I thought that would be particularly important given what's going on in the world today and the historic role and the potential role that students can play in standing up against all this. Opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Sasha Abramski, who wrote in the Sacramento Bee last month this: "As Trump consolidates his power, the history of 1930s Germany repeats itself." He wrote about what happened when the great mass of citizenry either supported the transformation or sat back and did nothing. And damn, if that didn't make you sit up and say, "What? Was that here? Was he the..." Yeah, that's true. Sasha, welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning, man. As I was saying, reading what you've written, I was really, really taken back. I mean, I thought this is something that people need to hear about because for far too many people, they've normalized a lot of things. So I wanted to ask you this: fascism, it can't happen here. That's a lot of what people are thinking. But you bring lessons from Germany and say, actually, it can, it did, and it could right here now. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, what I've been writing about for the last several years is the fact that when norms start breaking down, it's very easy for the great mass of people, the sort of apathetic middle, the people who sort of hope for a return to normalcy, the people who don't really want to pay attention to politics in the first place, to sort of sit back and say, oh, well, we're different. We have something exceptional about American history that guarantees permanent democracy. And it's certainly true that the way our Constitution is crafted, we got a lot of breaking mechanisms built in to try and constrain demagogy and to try and constrain a march to tyranny. But it's also true, when you look at the last couple of years, that Trump and his administration have shattered one norm after another. And they've done it both deliberately and also simply because they're full of bluster and they're full of hatred and they're full of nastiness. And every time they enact a policy, they go after another vulnerable group. And, you know, I'm always haunted by that quote from Nazi Germany, that quote about first they came for the socialists and I didn't do anything because I wasn't a socialist. And then they came for the trade unionists and I didn't do anything because I wasn't a trade unionist. And it goes on. And finally it says, and then they came for the Jews and there was no one left to defend me. And I've always been haunted by that idea that when a civic society breaks down, it doesn't happen all at once, but it happens gradually. And what we're seeing in America at the moment is the erosion of one norm and one safeguard after another, and the corrosion of one institutional breaking mechanism after another. And as that happens, one group after another is targeted, whether it's dreamers, whether it's people with temporary protected status, whether it's pregnant women who come to the border and try and claim asylum, whether it's vulnerable young people who are being attacked by the police, that one thing after another, one group after another, is being rendered vulnerable. And if we sit back and if we just say, look, it can't happen here, we're going to sleepwalk into a disaster, because it can happen here. There's no guarantee that it will, but there are clearly impulses in play at the moment that are pushing America in a deeply authoritarian, dark direction.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about this. Let's dig into this a little bit more, because when you write about what happened in Germany, you say even among the best of people in Germany at the time, there was an idea that actually silence and disdain was effective opposition, that that's really what, if you just did that, if you just said, look, these guys are idiots, and you can see a lot of that today. You know, you can see a lot of that where people dismiss what Trump does, or they dismiss some of the people in his cabinet and all this. And meanwhile, he's like basically rolling out the whole fascist ground cover, and people are saying, look, you know, he's an idiot, the elections are coming up, all this other stuff. Let's talk about that in terms of what happened in Germany, that, you know, even among the best people, the idea that silence and disdain was effective opposition.
You know, a few things about the slide into first chaos and then authoritarian fascism of Germany have always intrigued me. And one of them is that Germany was one of the most cultured, sophisticated countries on earth in the Weimar period. It had this rich history. It was reinventing itself after the calamity of World War One. It had this thriving political culture in Weimar Germany. It was sexually tolerant. It was politically tolerant. It was an epicenter of artistic creativity. That was in the 1920s. And then the economic collapse, triggered by 1929, occurs. And by the early 30s, its economy is a wreck. People are homeless by the millions. They're unemployed by the millions. They're feeling humiliated. They're feeling humbled. They're looking for a fifth column of domestic enemies to blame. They're casting around for religious and racial minorities that they can target and scapegoat. And all of these things happen remarkably quickly. And when you look at Germany in the mid-1930s, in the early Nazi period, you see a few things. You see the first is that the scapegoaters are now in charge, and they're busy blaming Jews and communists and homosexuals and people they call degenerate artists and so on and so forth. And the second thing you see is that an awful lot of Germans are very comfortable with this because their economy is starting to rebound. And as long as Hitler delivers the economic goods, and as long as he continues to talk about national pride and putting Germany first and preventing other nations from laughing at Germany, and as long as he pulls out of international treaties with impunity, a large number of Germans are actually rather content with the situation, especially businessmen. They might not like Hitler. They might think he's crude and he's crass and vulgarities come out of his mouth, and they might not like his henchmen who run riot in the streets and intimidate journalists and all these things. But they'll tolerate the Nazis as long as the Nazis deliver tax cuts, as long as the Nazis deliver economic benefits and so on. And when you look at the parallels to today, there's a frightening similarity that for the vast majority of Americans, the people who aren't being directly targeted or aren't being directly brutalized or aren't being directly intimidated, there seems to be a trade-off. That, you know, they might not like Trump, they might not like the Republican Party at the moment, but a goodly number of them will sit back and tolerate it as long as the jobs are flowing, as long as the tax cuts are flowing, as long as their daily economic situation is okay. And that's horrifying calculus, because what it means is a large number of people in an authoritarian system become expendable. And they become expendable simply because the vast majority of people aren't willing to stand up to the government and to say, look, this is outrageous. You cannot intimidate and beat and brutalize people in our names. But as long as that outrage isn't there, there is room for an authoritarian government to do tremendous damage to civic culture.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sasha Abramski. Sasha is a writer and a professor at UC Davis, and we're talking about one of his more recent articles on fascism and Trump and fascism in Germany and what it has to do with what we're looking at today in this country and around the world in a lot of ways. You know, Sasha, tell me this, because one of the things is that, you know, and I keep thinking about this in a lot of ways, where there's a conceit that develops, and I don't know if conceit's necessarily the right word, but an idea that Hitler, you know, back then Hitler could be handled by the machinations of the conservative elites, that the idea that he was a bumpkin, as you said, who would collapse in the face of well-established ruling elite, and that didn't really work very well. In fact, Hitler went on and changed everything, right?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that, you know, again, the parallels are eerie. Hitler gets to become the supreme power of Germany, not through winning a majority at an election, but through winning a large minority. And he comes into power, and there's a political crisis, and eventually the president, Hindenburg, the old sort of rear guard, the last sort of lion of World War One in Germany's politics, Hindenburg basically brings Hitler into office and says, all right, I'm going to make you chancellor, but you're going to be chancellor of a coalition government. And so all of these traditional conservatives like von Papen, these business elites, these old military elites, the old diplomatic elites, they sort of hold their nose and they decide they can do business with Hitler because it's better than political chaos. And so they come into office and they make these private statements, very derogatory of Hitler, saying, look, he's a nothing, we can control him, we can have him in our corner in no time. And they think they can corral him. And instead, the exact opposite happens, that Hitler, who is derided by the elites, rapidly consolidates power, and within a year, all of the civic structures of Germany are breaking down. And the Reichstag, the parliament of Germany, is actually passing laws one after another, enabling extra-constitutional government, enabling all the excesses of Hitler's personalized rule. And all of the non-Nazis in the government, one after another, the so-called moderates are pushed out into oblivion. And again, the parallels today are eerie, that the traditional conservatives in the Republican Party, they didn't really like Trump, they held their nose, they thought he was vulgar, they didn't really like his nativism, but what they did like was the idea that they could get someone into power who they could control, they could get their judges into positions of power, they could deregulate the economy, they could get their tax cuts. Those are the big three things the Republican Party cared about. And they thought that they could get Trump to do all of that, and then he would roll over and be entirely in their corner. And instead what we've seen is, yes, he did pass tax cuts. He did sign tax cuts. He's gone after regulations with a vengeance. He's put this horrifying number of conservative judges into the courts. But he hasn't rolled over. Instead, what we're seeing is purges, one after another, of the so-called moderates, people like Rex Tillerson, or the institutions of government, whether it's the attacks on the Department of Justice or the FBI, or whether it's the attacks on the State Department as an institution. And what we're seeing is, one after another, the people who aren't simpatico with Trump's agenda are being driven out of office. And they're doing so with a quiescent Republican Congress, because the Republican Party is in thrall at the moment in this sort of sick cult of the personality. And so one part of their brain knows that Trump's pretty much a horror show, whether it's his personal life or his corruption or his willingness to tolerate and to promote brutality. But the other part of their brain is in thrall to the cult of the personality. And as long as that part of the brain is dominant, as long as a large number of Republicans are willing to say, well, in normal circumstances, we'd never tolerate a man whose lawyer paid $130,000 in hush money to a porn star, but these aren't normal circumstances. And as long as there's that caveat, these aren't normal circumstances, the cult of the personality holds. And as long as the cult of the personality holds, Trump can be as venal, as anti-democratic, as intimidatory, as thuggish as he likes, and the party will stay with him. And the longer it stays with him, the deeper the damage both to America's civic structure and also to America's standing in the world.
You know, one thing, Sasha, that I was thinking about when I was reading your piece, you know, it really struck me, too, that, look, you have a situation here where this was actually, the Weimar Republic was actually, you know, one of the most democratic institutions, one of the most democratic, you know, forms of government ever. You know, and this was, it was a very heavy thing for Hitler to come in that and be able to dismantle this so quickly and so easily in a lot of ways, and have many people, as you're pointing out, go along with him. And I wanted to ask you this, and we'll be wrapping it up, I think, with this one, but you can spend some time on it too. So the idea that actually not, there was that aspect of things, but then how easy, relatively easy it was to do this. And there's a question I think that's posed for a lot of people, which is, you know, many people in Germany thought that the way things operate as usual, we'll have a way to, you know, to deal with this. He won't be able to do all this. You mentioned this in the earlier things you were saying, but there was that idea of sort of this, the most democratic country in the world, blah, 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 could be, you know, will eventually find its way out of this mess. And more, it raises now, when you look back on it, it raises more of a question of when good citizens simply watch and do nothing in the face of all this, it's a horror.
I think that's right. I mean, the thing about Weimar Germany is it was a country that has sort of arisen from the ashes of the, not just defeat, but the vast generational trauma of World War One. And in the wake of that, it had reinvented itself. It had gone from being a country governed by a monarch, the Kaiser, to being a constitutional democracy. It had a very vibrant, pluralistic political process. And the other thing was, it had this extraordinarily dynamic culture. So the great cities, especially Berlin, were these epicenters of art and music, dancing. They were very celebratory in a way, quite decadent in some ways. And the elites congregated in those cities thought it was completely inconceivable that all of that could be rolled back. But the thing was, they were just the elites, the cultural elites, the urban elites, and so on. And there was this great mass of Germans outside of that culture, a great mass of Germans who felt humiliated, who felt economically insecure, who had been nurturing anti-Semitic impulses for generations at that point, who were desperately looking for scapegoats to explain away the humiliation of a lost world war. And all of those people provided easy fodder for the demagogy of a Hitler. And, you know, you look at America today, and again, there are tremendous parallels. There are also differences. But the parallels are that you had these urban elites in New York and in L.A. and San Francisco and so on who thought they had remade the world in their image. And then you had an awful lot of people in the hinterlands who felt disenfranchised, disempowered, who felt economically vulnerable, who felt that the trends of the world were going against them and going against their children, and who were deeply nervous about the future. And those people provided easy fodder for the demagogy of Donald Trump. And Trump was a master in 2016 at playing to their fears and at exacerbating their fears. And so the danger to me is that, you know, history never repeats itself exactly. It always repeats itself with variation. But the danger is that we now have a deeply demagogic, scapegoating national leadership in America in control of all of the vast economic and political and military power that goes along with being in charge of the most powerful country on earth. And the potential for disaster is immense, because you have a government now that has no moral constraints, no moral limits. You have a president who has indicated his willingness, at least rhetorically, to talk about using nuclear weapons. You have the immense potential for a bloody, catastrophic denouement to this period in American history. And so I guess where I'd wrap it up is I'd say, look, you know, the parallels with the past are always going to be parallels with a variance. So it's not that Hitler and Trump are exact equivalents. It's not that Weimar Germany and 1990s or early 2000s America are exact equivalents. And it's not that the Third Reich and Trump's America are exact equivalents. But there are disturbing enough similarities that we do not have room for complacency at the moment.
All right, Sasha Abramsky, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again, man. Okay?
All right.
All right, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Sasha Abramsky. Sasha is, he's a professor at UC Davis, and he's a writer for many, many outlets. And one of the things you can find is you can find his article on the Sacramento Bee, on everything that we've just been talking about. You can find that article on the Sacramento Bee article on refusefascism.org. All right, and go there, you'll look it up, you'll find a lot of other things too. It's really worth digging into. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. All right, I could have just kept on going all morning on that, but I'm not, because we can't keep on going, all right? And that's Sly and Robbie with Free at Last. Yeah, that'll be a day, won't it? All right, right now, I want to, a very serious part of the show, as all of it today is serious, but this is something that I think is really important for people to listen to pay attention to. And, you know, if you've been listening to the show regularly, you know that I've been pumping out a special talk by Bob Avakian, given by Bob Avakian, you know, months ago in the latter part of the 2017. The name of the speech was "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible." And as part of that, which I really emphasize that people need to go and hear that, and you can find that at revcom.us. But go and listen to it and spread it around everywhere, because that speech, actually, it's something that basically is what you need to actually get to change the horror that we're living in right now. You're not going to do it without that speech, I'll tell you that. You're not going to do it without the stuff that's brought up in that speech. All right, and you should really, really take it seriously, listen to it. And as a part of that, we're going to be featuring today a section from the questions and answer part of the speech. And it's basically, he was asked, could you speak to the role of students, including that there have been vicious attacks on critical thinking at known liberal or historically radical places such as Berkeley, and how should we approach bringing students forward to the call of refuse fascism as well as unleashing them in that process? So without any further ado, this is Bob Avakian.
The question is, could you speak to the role of students, including that there have been vicious attacks on critical thinking at known liberal or historically radical places, i.e. Berkeley, and how should we approach bringing students forward to the call of refused fascism, as well as unleashing them in that process?
Students, where are you? No, I mean, look, it's not just, you know, my generation, you know, whatever. And every significant, you know, and positive social movement and struggle, students have always played a really important role. And, you know, one of the things that I think is important is, you know, not just for me personally, but I feel it's important in a broader sense, to understand, you know, frankly, what is weighing on students? What is keeping them from playing more the kind of role? I'm not saying that there are no positive things happening with students. There certainly are. You know, when Betsy DeVos has gone places, students have done good things in you know, standing up against her. When Sessions has gone to campuses, students have done good things. There have been many good things done by students, and I don't want to ignore or diminish the importance of that. But it's not yet on the level it needs to be, and I think it's important to understand what is weighing on the students. I mean, you know, we know some things, like very different than when I was a student back, you know, in some entirely different era. There was no such thing as this massive student debt that there is now. And I have a sense from talking to people and from what I've read and so on, that this is a big weight on people. That, you know, there was a certain period, you know, when the Soviet Union put Sputnik into orbit back in the late 1950s, all of a sudden the U.S., you know, powers that be freaked out, decided they needed a space program and, you know, and they needed more educated people. So they opened up the colleges, and they also had the, you know, economic situation to be able to do this. They opened up the colleges to much broader numbers of particularly white people, although some people of color as well. But they opened it up much more broadly than it had been before, and it was relatively cheap. And so you could go to college in those days to pursue, I know it sounds corny, but it was real, to pursue the life of the mind. You didn't have to think at every moment about how does what I'm doing now going to affect my ability to earn money and pay off my debt, you know, 5, 10, 15 years from now. And then also, you know, that kind of atmosphere, that pursuit of the life of the mind is very important for any positive development in society, including any positive, you know, radical student movement. You know, I can remember, you know, when I got involved in, you know, in the student movement and the free speech movement in Berkeley and so on, we would, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but we really would, you know, we'd sit around and you could go somewhere and get a cup of coffee very cheaply, and they didn't kick you out, so, you know, outside the campus, and you sit around and you'd talk about poetry, then you'd talk about philosophy, and then you'd talk about the Vietnam War. And, you know, there was this kind of vigorous intellectual life and curiosity. You know, and people had all kinds of ideas about, you know, existential ideas, what's human existence all about, you know, and some of it was just bull. But some of it was actually, you know, stretched your mind, got you to thinking. And all that contributed to people not wanting to accept the world the way it was. And not thinking that, well, that's just the way things are, you just have to accept these outrages. And I don't have a sense, and I wish I had more of a sense, to be honest, of how much that kind of thing goes on among the students these days, or how much it's suffocated by other things. So that's one thing. You know, we need to learn more, and I still believe that there is tremendous potential among students to be a very positive force. You know, there are very positive qualities about youth. Okay, that in every generation, you know, not being stuck in your ways, not to, being willing to just say, well, that's just the way things are. You know, a curiosity, even if a lot of that has been tamped down by some of these things I was talking about. And students, you know, have very positive qualities as well. They do, even with all the debt and everything that goes on and the general dumbing down of the society, frankly, they do engage in a lot of, you know, ideas. And that's very important. engaging in critical thinking, engaging in ideas, wrestling with different ideas, sorting things out is very important. So I think there is a lot of potential for students. But there are things weighing on them, like this debt. And let's talk about something else that's been holding people back, and that's identity politics. The idea that if you're not part of a certain identity group, it's not your place to stand up against injustices that are directed against that group. Look, our first and most fundamental identity is as part of humanity. That's our first and most fundamental identity. And look, it's one thing to say that people who directly experience oppression have a lot to say about that and should be listened to. That's very true and very important. Let me make an analogy I've made before. If you're in the medical profession and people come to you and you don't even listen to them describe the symptoms or talk about how it's affecting them and what it means for them, you are not going to be a good medical professional. But if you listen to them and then say, well, I wish you luck, I hope you're able to do something about it, it's not my place to have anything to say about it, you're also a terrible medical professional, okay? And the analogy I'm making is, if you don't listen to and seek to learn from people who are directly experiencing something, including a terrible oppression, then you're not going to do good things. If you are arrogant and don't think you have anything to learn about that, or you think you can just tell everybody what to do without really trying to learn, then you're going to do bad things. But it's also very bad if you have the attitude that, well, that's happening to somebody else, I don't like it, I wish them well, but it's not my place to do anything about it. You are also doing very bad things. You're a human being. These are other human beings that are being, you know, subjected to this. If you feel that it's an outrage, you should act. You should do everything you can. You should do everything you can to join with other people to fight against this and with the aim of putting a stop to it. This is, but the, you know, and let's be honest. Let's say you're not part of the identity group. Well, how easy is it for you? You know, how perfect is it for you to have somebody tell you that's not your place to be involved? Oh, well, I'm so glad. You know, I thought I might have to actually sacrifice something. I'm so glad that you're telling me that I don't have to do anything about this. Except, you know, listen to you tell me how terrible it is. No. We all should have an attitude that anything that's done that's an injustice has to be fought against. And we should all have an attitude of learning from each other and seeking the truth about things. And yes, there is a history in this country. I mean, it's just woven through the entire fabric of this country. You know, of people in the dominant group, in the oppressor group, even well-intentioned ones, being condescending to people of the dominated and oppressed group and thinking that they have nothing to learn from them, or that that the people in that group, you know, couldn't possibly have any important ideas of their own and so on. This is a real problem, okay, and we should get rid of that. But at the same time, the most fundamental thing is, what is the actual truth of things? What does the evidence actually show? And what should we, as people who care about, you know, what kind of world we live in, and who want a world where people are not unnecessarily suffering and subjected to totally unjustified oppression, what is our responsibility in that context? So, you know, I don't know how much these things are, you know, the different elements I mentioned are affecting students, but I do know that students potentially can still play a really powerful role, and we have to go to them and challenge them to play that role and unite with them where they are inclined to or where they have taken initiative to do so, and struggle with them where they go off track or don't see what's actually happening, or in one way or another are misdirected away from actually doing what needs to be done to stand up against this. So the students, it's very important. We gotta go into the campuses and talk with people, you know, directly and straightforwardly about what's happening and listen to what they have to say. You know, one of the most egregious, you know, problems we face is extreme. This is a land, let's just put it simply, this is a land of unbelievably extreme individualism. You know, well, you know, look, even among the most oppressed, you know, some of you may know our party, you know, is leading, you know, people in Chicago to go among the youth in particular who are, you know, living under this horrific system, are being driven to kill each other in horrific numbers. And, you know, we're going to them directly and saying, you know, get out of that. I mean, I'm using shorthand, but get out of that and get into the revolution. Get into what's really in your interests. And, you know, a lot of the people, you go up to them, you know, I'm doing good, you know. I'm not oppressed, you know. I'm making out okay, you know. Yeah, you're making out great. You know, you're in the south side of Chicago, you know, in the hole that's been, you know, turned into a desolation row by this system that's deserted any kind of, you know, deserted any pretense of providing a decent life for you. Has left you in this situation where one of the few alternatives you have is to get into crime and to be fighting each other over little pieces of territory that you have no control over anyway. But even among the most oppressed, I'm doing fine. I'm not oppressed. I'm making out for me. I got to think about me. And this exists among all strata of people. And think about this, if everybody says, I gotta go for me, where are we going to be? Where are we going to end up? Mm-hmm. Where we are now and worse. Because there are much bigger things happening in the world than what you are doing for you. How come you're standing on the street corner, hanging out, looking to see if an enemy from another set comes onto your block? How come that's what you're doing with your life? Is that, oh, I see. From the time you're a little kid, that's what your mother or your parents or whatever said, this is what I want my son or daughter to do. And I'm going to work hard so that they can end up doing that. No, that's because there are much bigger forces at work. That's because of the whole history that I was talking about. The whole situation that goes back and back, but, you know, we could take a certain phase of it from the time of slavery, and then after slavery, and then after World War II, people leaving the South, fleeing from the South in millions, going to places like Chicago, looking for a better life, hoping to get away from the horror and terror of what existed, you know, in Ku Klux Klan country. And getting a job in a factory, in a steel mill or a meat packing plant or whatever. And then a couple of generations later, all those jobs are gone. All those companies have closed up and gone other places or been taken over by other companies that are now investing in some place like Haiti or Pakistan or Bangladesh. That's why you're standing on the corner doing what you're doing right now. Not because you decided that that's what you were going to do with your life, but somebody, or more to the point, a system, decided that for you and put you there and doesn't give a damn about you and sends its cops out to call you a nigger or whatever and shoot you down like you're a dog or worse. So this individualism is working against what we need. And it isn't just among the most oppressed. It's among all sections of the people. And people have to understand that the bigger things going on in the world are going to, first of all, are going to affect them, whether they think so or like it or not. Who, you know, a lot of people, you know, didn't expect Trump to be president. All of a sudden you get this, you know, well, I have a lot of nouns I could use, but anyway, you get this guy and this regime in there, right? Well, that affects your whole life. You know, you go along with your own life. I'm doing what I'm doing for myself, whether you're a student or whatever you are. And all of a sudden, the world changes in ways that are much bigger than you. So we got to get people to look to the bigger things. We got to get people to look, understand the larger forces at work and what those larger forces are dragging things toward. And therefore, how we got to move to do things. And again, there are a lot of things people are doing, including students, and we should welcome that. We should learn more about it. We should unite with people. We should talk with them and listen to their ideas about what should happen. And we should struggle with them and about, you know, the need to direct this toward driving out this regime as the immediate challenge before us. And we should listen to them and what they have to say about what they're encountering among other students and other people, you know, that are posing obstacles and discuss with them how can we break through on this in a way that we need to very quickly.
All right, welcome back. That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and from the Q&A section of a talk he gave a while back called The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. And sisters and brothers, this is a talk that can change the political conversation. And more than that, it's a talk that can actually make all the difference in the world and whether or not actually humanity and the globe are going to continue to exist. This is a talk that is aimed at, that is figured out, is aimed at and mobilizing people to stop this fascist regime. All right, and for people from all kinds of people to come together to do that. And this is a talk that should be spread to everybody you know. And you can find it at revcom.us. All right, once again, that's revcom.us. And I also want to make an announcement from Refuse Fascism LA. Stop Trump's militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border. Stand with the Central American caravan. This nightmare must end. The Trump-Pence regime must go. There's a press conference today, Friday, April 6th at 4 p.m. at the National Guard Recruiter at 1300, that's 1300 Federal Avenue. And you can call for more information. You can call 323-946-1742. 323-946-1742. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
I waited all my life to play, but I still can't find a way. I might just break the chain. I might just break the chain. I might just break the chain.
All right, welcome back. Lupe Fiasco with Break the Chains, all right? That is something, all right, I play that song 9 or 10 times a day, okay? Just love that song. I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show Andy Z. Andy's spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City, and he's the co-initiator of RefuseFascism.org. And he's going to talk with us about what's going on in relation to the struggle to basically refuse fascism, to break this down, to drive them out. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Sure. You know, one thing I was thinking as I was sitting here, we've had sort of a thematic thing going on here at the show today, and it's been very heavy, I think. You know, the discussion with Sasha early on, the Q&A section of the talk from BA, and it's something when you look at that, there's a press that's going on. There's a real need and a necessity for people to be breaking this stuff down, but also for people giving people the ability to actually step up and go out and take this stuff on in the way that it needs to be taken on. You know, I know you've been following this a lot, so it's not new to you, but I thought you might want to, you know, comment on that because you came in at just the right moment, brother.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. It's actually a very, very rich show. There's a lot that, both Sasha Abramsky brought forward and certainly that Q&A One of the questions among several that were part of in the addendums to the film that you referenced earlier, The Trump-Pence Must Go, it's talked by Bob Avakian in October of 2017. Look, I think Sasha, you know, he made many important points, but he, in saying that we, that the greatest danger we face is complacency, this is a very profound point, and, you know, it can roll off the tongue, but it actually means that people are going to have to act to stop this. And one of the things that, you know, to not repeat what he said, actually, but to actually add to it and develop some of what and highlight the film that Avakian brought forward, is that we have to understand that fascism actually does represent a qualitative change in the form in which the society is ruled. It doesn't mean it's a different system. It's still the capitalist imperialist system. It's still a system that, you know, that is a system of empire around the world, and that is done horrific things to people in this country since its foundation. But this is a qualitative change in the form of rule, which means essentially the evisceration of democratic rights, the civic rights, the civil society, and, you know, these are the norms that Sasha was talking about are being shattered. And when you get to that point where there is a qualitative change, sort of a more blatant form of dictatorship, if you will, and I would assert that the that we always live under a dictatorship of a system, but this is and a class of people. But this is really a qualitative change that if you don't recognize it before it consolidates, then you've got yourself a big problem, and makes it much much harder for every form of struggle to be waged. Now the other thing is, and you got a sense of this in the answer that Avakian was given to what about the students, where he's talking about. They are the kind of atmosphere in society, the kind of ideas, and the history of the country. And this talk, which I would commend to your readers, I know you do, your listeners, you do this all the time on your show, but it's really important because Avakian goes into the roots of fascism in the system itself. You know, and we have to face up to the fact this is not the first time fascism has occurred under this system. There's Italy, there's Germany, there's Japan in the last century, and right now there's fascist regimes springing up all over the world, including right here. And then Avakian goes very deeply into this talk, into the roots of an American fascism in the whole history of this country, of genocide of the native people, slavery, and the misogyny that ran through the culture of this country and the actual laws of this country, and so that it should not be an anomaly or something like, how could it happen here? This is actually the history of a country. If you have a country that has the largest prison population in the world, and percentage-wise it's through the roof, why should you be surprised that there's a fascist government that is coming to power and attempting to impose its rule? So, you know, this is my perspective on this, and in terms of the root causes, and, you know, I share this with and have learned from what Avakian has done in terms of the roots of this, as well as the solution, and that indeed we must now unite to stop this. And that means people of all different political persuasions, all different points of view, need to come together and recognize this as the danger that sits right in front of us. And then as such, and in that process, myself and others, you know, as a spokesperson of the Revolution Bookstores, we want to move beyond this system. But that is not immediately on the agenda. What is on the agenda is all kinds of people uniting today to defeat this regime through mass nonviolent protest that involves ultimately millions of people from many different points of view uniting together. And that's what Refuse Fascism is formed around.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, as you're speaking, I was thinking about this a little, because it's sort of one of the things that Sasha talks about in the article that he wrote, and I think actually is something that I've been thinking a lot about, is the fact that they're actually in the face of, like, you know, all these developments that are very, I mean, you're pointing them out, and Avakian's pointed them out, Sasha was pointing them out earlier in the conversations here, but there is this thing that's developed where, you know, like in Germany, it was a lot of, like, sort of people who should have known better, you know, sort of looked for ways short of totally assaulting and dismantling this rising fascist regime. And in a way, there's this, you know, it seems to me, I kept thinking about this last night, there's a need for people here to be aware of the character of the situation we face today and what it demands from us. And I think it's really, I mean, look, they're consolidating their fascist machinery in a big hurry, and it's going to mean horror, as we've already seen already in the rest of the world, as you were referring to. But there's a point of people really need to cast aside illusions and self-delusions.
Yeah, I think that's true. That people do need to cast aside illusions. Actually, there's an article on refusefascism.org called "The Continuity of the Past Does Not Negate the Urgency of the Present," and this is an important point that people do. The parallel with Weimar Germany, which was that period of a florescence of democratic culture and culture in Germany, and Sasha's right, it was often most located in the cities in a certain elite strata there, and a belief that that would continue. Germany, of course, was in a very different position than the U.S. is. Germany was a defeated power at that point, severe restrictions on it in its geopolitical aspirations, all this kind of stuff. But let's be clear, the U.S. itself, as the sole superpower, has been under increasing duress in many different directions, including internationally, which, engaged now in the longest war in its history with no end in sight in Afghanistan and certainly throughout the Mideast, and as well as a changing demographics, changing population, globalization. All these kinds of things has led to a section of very powerful people have been developing a fascist movement in this country over the past 30, 40 years. And perhaps it surprised Trump and it surprised them, but Trump has been able to speak to that diverse social base and it's shown the willingness and the ability to shatter every norm. This is a point Sasha was making, to shatter all these norms such to bring about a different coherence in the ruling class. So this is what we're facing. Now you've got the majority of, or a big section of the U.S., not the majority, but a big section of the people in the United States have lived a relatively comfortable life, different from Germany. There wasn't even Germany. They had just gone through a world war. People here haven't had a war in continental United States since the Civil War, and there's been relative political stability, except for the period of the 1960s, which was something we need to learn a lot from, even as we weren't able to succeed in that period. So you have this political complacency and stability that's based on an economic foundation, but we've got to get beyond that, and people have to look at what's coming and what the implications are, and this gets really sharply posed right now with the formation of this war cabinet, this cabal of people, Haspel, an absolute war criminal being pointed to the head of the CIA. This is somebody who should have been convicted of war crimes and torturing people. Pompeo, now head of, or about to be confirmed as head of the State Department, just really a verifiable lunatic, right of Dr. Strangelove, okay? These are the people, and then what can you say about Bolton, other than this is a straight-up fascist who's advocating using first strike weapons. These people are extremely dangerous, and Mad Dog Mattis isn't going to restrain them. So it is a time when people have to cast away these illusions and delusions and self-delusions and look at what's actually in the offing. And that's something we really should talk about. I say we should talk about, not necessarily on this broadcast in full, but actually over the coming weeks. You have the Iran deal coming up. You have this negotiation with North Korea. Both of these are tripwires that could lead to an absolute catastrophe for the people of the world, for people in this country, and for humanity as a whole, and even the survival of humanity, should it spin out of control, which just, by the way, can happen.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that's extremely important, because I was thinking as you were speaking about this, it's exactly that point. I mean, look, there's a point. We still are faced with this very dangerous normalization. And that there's this stuff that's going on where people, I don't know. I mean, they're looking at, the drag of sort of, well, we have an election coming up, all this other stuff that you're referring to. But there's really this point of people do need to step up, recognize what's going on, and then decide on what needs to be done in this. And I think that's really important in terms of what we're talking about. There's a historic challenge that has to be carried out, or the planet could disappear.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, this coming Wednesday, Refuse Fascism. It's not Refuse Fashion. People should continue to be fashionable, but Refuse Fascism is calling a national meeting. We're having the 30 minutes of live stream from New York. It's happening in cities around the country. It's happening in Los Angeles at 6:30 p.m. at the Trinity Episcopal Church, 650 North, I don't know how to pronounce it, Berendo Street, Los Angeles, California. You can look it up on the website, I guess. But these meetings, we're going to be announcing our plan for 2018 and a new call to act. And, you know, we do begin this by saying that we are resolving that nothing short of removing this whole illegitimate regime from power will stop the nightmare of the Trump-Pence regime, and that there is a way to do it, but we got to cast aside illusions and self-delusions, which is that this is just part of the normal processes of elections, just a protest now and again and around particular things by itself will change the situation, and that we have to be, and this is a point that Sasha also brought up, and it's something that Avakian really was hammering home in that answer, speaking about the students, is just because something isn't happening directly to you doesn't mean it's not happening. And if you want to live in a world that's not like this one, if you want to live in a world that's about justice, then if something is happening to other people, you have to act against it. Just because it's not happening to you doesn't mean it's not happening, and it does also means it's not something you should tolerate, or you're going to get the worst of what could come, including it could affect you. That's the point of that Pastor Niemöller quote. First they came for the communists, and I wasn't a communist, so I did nothing. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did nothing, to the point where they came for me, and there was no one left to stand up.
Mm-hmm.
I will say this. We do put on the front page of our new call, I'm just going to preview it, but people should come listen to this live stream and come to the meeting in Los Angeles or in other cities that's happening around the country. We say if we are not as outraged and motivated to act today as we were right after the election, we are on our way to accepting a great horror that builds daily. If we adjust to the injustice of this regime, do not ask how the German people could have accepted Nazism in the 1930s.
Yeah, that was something that really grabbed me when I read that, man. It was really, it makes you sit up and think, and hopefully it'll make you sit up and stand up and do something. You know, one of the things that when we have a few minutes, we have maybe 4 minutes left, something like that, a little bit less. But also, I wanted to let people know it's Berendo. And could you, right now, could you just read that announcement you made again so people know where this is? It's on Berendo Street. But what's that? What was the?
Yeah. Okay. So hold on. Let me just grab it again. The announcement is that is for people to join with people all around the country who are going to be tuning in and also taking part in meetings. The meetings will be longer than the half-hour national live stream broadcast. It's about what are we facing and how are we going to stop the catastrophe that is the American fascism of the Trump-Pence regime. That's at 6:30 p.m. at the Trinity Episcopal Church at 650 North Berenda Street in Los Angeles. It's also at 6:30 in Chicago, Boston, New York, and I'm not sure of the time in the Bay Area, but you can check that out if people are listening on the internet in one of those other cities. And if you're someplace else in the world, you can tune into refusefascism.org to get a live stream link to the half-hour introduction to this. At the meetings, we're going to be discussing plans for how do we go from a situation where there's millions of people outraged at the situation, probably tens of thousands of people acting around one outrage or another, whether it's the situation with women, the Black Lives Matter, the DACA students, the DACA youth, immigration, climate change, scientists are marching next weekend, and a situation where there's actually relatively few thousand people who are determined at this point that the whole regime must go through mass struggle, mass nonviolent struggle, if you want to put it this way, on the model of what happened in South Korea in 2016, 15-16, where they amassed in the streets day after day, night after night, until the president was removed from power, impeached, and then indicted, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So the plans for this are going to be revealed at these meetings. Not everything will be on the live stream, so if you're interested and need to take part of it, you should be interested and you should take part. So get out to this meeting at that church in Los Angeles or whatever city you're in.
All right, Andy, do you have anything else you want to add before we go out?
Well, two things. I mean, one is to go to One is to go to this website, refusefascism.org, and sign up, sign the call. You can read it there. As advanced copy is up on the website, and take part in this movement. And two, if you really want to understand, and you do need to understand what we're facing, go to either refusefascism.org or revcom.us and watch this film by Bob Avakian and watch the Q&A and get into the causes of this and to the solutions. And I would also commend to your listeners an article by Avakian that is titled The Problem. I'm sorry, that's not the title. The title is The Right-Wing Conspiracy and Why the Democrats Are No Answer. This is also on the website revcom.us. It's an incredible analysis of the roots of this American fascism, of manifest destiny, the Bible taken literally, misogyny, white supremacy, and xenophobia. The roots of all this in the history, including the present history of the U.S. So I would recommend that to your listeners.
All right, Andy, thank you very much for joining us today, and I look forward to talking to you again soon, man.
Yeah, by the way, Michael, I'm going to be in L.A. in late May, and, you know, we'll be having some big events, and we'll announce them soon.
Good, and we'll have you on the show to talk about it. There you go.
Okay, great.
All right, man, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We've just been talking with Andy Zee, spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City and co-initiator, and actually I think all Revolution Books, and co-initiator of RefuseFascism.org. And we've been talking about the situation today and what people need to do about it, what it poses for us and what we need to do. And I want to thank all of my guests. I want to thank the Sasha Abramsky. I want to thank Bob Avakian for giving that speech and actually making it available. And I want to thank my board op for today, Teddy Robinson, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to listen, if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And I want to give out a shout out to Jeff Pryor, our assistant producer, who is still also, he's laid up a little, but he's actually getting better and coming back soon. All right. At least I hope. Talk to you soon, Jeff. And we're going to go out now. We're going to go out now with Let's Make History from International Noise Conspiracy. Talk to you again next week.
Sergio Melnichenko, your host of Global Village Fridays. This Friday, my special guest is Grammy-nominated guitarist, composer, and producer David Becker. We'll feature tracks from his album, The Lonely Road, as well as a special live performance this Friday. The Global Village starts at 11 a.m. right here on KPFK Los Angeles. The Global Village, with music from around the world and around the block.
This is Laura Flanders. You're listening to People Powered Radio, KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. Support KPFK by texting the number 41444 and entering KPFK. Texting a pledge is a quick and easy way to support the station that supports you.
Spotlight Africa speaks to a different African reality.
I think we need to begin to engage as equals rather than begin to engage as if we are Africa is a territory where people from outside have a right.